was from 40 to 80% for children with parents in the top quartile. In other words, parents' income has become an almost perfect predictor of university access. This inequality of access also seems to exist at the top of the economic hierarchy, not only because of the high cost of attending the most prestigious private universities, high even in relation to the income of upper-middle-class parents, but also because admissions decisions clearly depend in significant ways on the parents' financial capacity to make donations to the universities. For example, one study has shown that gifts by graduates to their former universities are strangely concentrated in the period when the children are of college age. By comparing various sources of data, moreover, it is possible to estimate that the average income of the parents of Harvard students is currently about $450,000, which corresponds to the average income of the top 2% of the U.S. income hierarchy. Such a finding does not seem entirely compatible with the idea of selection based solely on merit. The contrast between the official meritocratic discourse and the reality seems particularly extreme in this case. The total absence of transparency regarding selection procedures should also be noted. It would be wrong, however, to imagine that unequal access to higher education is a problem solely in the United States. It is one of the most important problems that social states everywhere must face in the 21st century. To date, no country has come up with a truly satisfactory response. To be sure, university tuitions fees are much lower in Europe if one leaves Britain aside. In other countries, including Sweden and other Nordic countries, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, tuition fees are relatively low, less than 500 euros. Although there are exceptions, such as business schools and Sciences Po in France, and although the situation is changing rapidly, this remains a very striking difference between continental Europe and the United States. In Europe, most people believe that access to higher education should be free, or nearly free, just as primary and secondary education are. In Quebec, the decision to raise tuition gradually from $2,000 to nearly $4,000 was interpreted as an attempt to move toward an inegalitarian U.S.-style system, which led to a student strike in the winter of 2012, and ultimately to a change of government and cancellation of the decision. It would be naive, however, to think that free higher education would resolve all problems. In 1964, Pierre Bourdieu and Jean-Claude Passeron analyzed in Les Héritiers more subtle mechanisms of social and cultural selection, which often do the same work as financial selection. In practice, the French system of grande école leads to spending more public money on students from more advantaged social backgrounds, while less money is spent on university students who come from more modest backgrounds. Again, the contrast between the official discourse of Republican meritocracy and the reality, in which social spending amplifies inequalities of social origin, is extreme. According to the available data, it seems that the average income of parents of students at Sciences Po is currently around 90,000 euros, which roughly corresponds to the top 10% of the French income hierarchy. Recruitment is thus five times broader than at Harvard, but still relatively limited. We lack the data to do a similar calculation for students at the other grande école, but the results would likely be similar. Make no mistake, there is no easy way to achieve real equality of opportunity in higher education. This will be a key issue for the social state in the 21st century, and the ideal system has yet to be invented. Tuition fees create an unacceptable inequality of access, but they foster the independence, prosperity, and energy that make U.S. universities the envy of the world. In the abstract, it should be possible to combine the advantages of decentralization with those of equal access by providing universities with substantial publicly financed incentives. In some respects, this is what public health insurance systems do. Producers, doctors, and hospitals are granted a certain independence, but the cost of care is a collective responsibility, thus ensuring that patients have equal access to the system. One could do the same thing with universities and students. The Nordic countries have adopted a strategy of this kind in higher education. This, of course, requires substantial public financing, which is not easy to come by in the current climate of consolidation of the social state. Such a strategy is nevertheless far more satisfactory than other recent attempts, which range from charging tuition fees that vary with parents' income to offering loans that are to be paid back by a surtax added to the recipient's income tax. If we are to make progress on these issues in the future, it would be good to begin by working toward greater transparency than exists today. In the United States, France, and most other countries, talk about the virtues of the national meritocratic model is seldom based on close examination of the facts. Often the purpose is to justify existing inequalities while ignoring the sometimes patent failures of the current system. In 1872, Émile Boutmy created Sciences Po with a clear mission in mind. Obliged to submit to the rule of the majority, the classes that call themselves the upper classes can preserve their political hegemony only by invoking the rights of the most capable. As traditional upper-class prerogatives crumble, the wave of democracy will encounter a second rampart built on eminently useful talents, superiority that commands prestige, and abilities of which society cannot sanely deprive itself. If we take this incredible statement seriously, what it clearly means is that the upper classes instinctively abandoned idleness and invented meritocracy lest universal suffrage deprive them of everything they owned. One can, of course, chalk this up to the political context. The Paris Commune had just been put down, and universal male suffrage had just been re-established. Yet Boutmy's statement has the virtue of reminding us of an essential truth. Defining the meaning of inequality and justifying the position of the winners is a matter of vital importance, and one can expect to see all sorts of misrepresentations of the facts in service of the cause. The future of retirement, pay as you go, and low growth. Public pension systems are generally pay as you go, pay-go systems. Contributions deducted from the wages of active workers are directly paid out as benefits to retirees. In contrast to capitalized pension plans, in a pay-go system, nothing is invested, and incoming funds are immediately dispersed to current retirees. In pay-go schemes, based on the principle of intergenerational solidarity, today's workers pay benefits to today's retirees in the hope that their children will pay their benefits tomorrow, the rate of return is by definition equal to the growth rate of the economy. The contributions available to pay tomorrow's retirees will rise as average wages rise. In theory, this only implies that today's active workers have an interest in ensuring that average wages rise as rapidly as possible. They should therefore invest in schools and universities for their children and promote a higher birth rate. In other words, there exists a bond among generations that in principle makes for a virtuous and harmonious society. When pay-go systems were introduced in the middle of the 20th century, conditions were in fact ideal for such a virtuous series of events to occur. Demographic growth was high, and productivity growth higher still. The growth rate was close to 5% in the countries of continental Europe, so this was the rate of return on the pay-go system. Concretely, workers who contributed to state retirement funds between the end of World War II and 1980 were repaid, or are still being repaid, out of much larger wage pools than those from which their contributions were drawn. The situation today is different. The falling growth rate, now around 1.5% in the rich countries, and perhaps ultimately in all countries, reduces the return on the pool of shared contributions. All signs are that the rate of return on capital in the 21st century will be significantly higher than the growth rate of the economy. 4 to 5% for the former, barely 1.5% for the latter. Under these conditions, it is tempting to conclude that the pay-go system should be replaced as quickly as possible by a capitalized system, in which contributions by active workers are invested rather than paid out immediately to retirees. These investments can then grow at 4% a year in order to finance the pensions of today's workers when they retire several decades from now. There are several major flaws in this argument, however. First, even if we assume that a capitalized system is indeed preferable to a pay-go system, the transition from pay-go to capitalized benefits raises a fundamental problem. An entire generation of retirees is left with nothing. The generation that is about to retire, who paid for the pensions of the previous generation with their contributions, would take a rather dim view of the fact that the contributions of today's workers, which current retirees had expected to pay their rent and buy their food during the remaining years of their lives, would in fact be invested in assets around the world. There is no simple solution to this transition problem, and this alone makes such a reform totally unthinkable, at least in such an extreme form. Second, in comparing the merits of the two pension systems, one must bear in mind that the return on capital is in practice extremely volatile. It would be quite risky to invest all retirement contributions in global financial markets. The fact that R is greater than G on average does not mean that it is true for each individual investment. For a person of sufficient means, who can wait 10 or 20 years before taking her profits, the return on capital is indeed quite attractive. But when it comes to paying for the basic necessities of an entire generation, it would be quite irrational to bet everything on a roll of the dice. The primary justification of the pay-go system is that it is the best way to guarantee that pension benefits will be paid in a reliable and predictable manner. The rate of wage growth may be less than the rate of return on capital, but the former is 5 to 10 times less volatile than the latter. This will continue to be true in the 21st century, and pay-go pensions will therefore continue to be part of the ideal social state of the future everywhere. That said, it remains true that the logic of R is greater than G cannot be entirely ignored, and some things may have to change in the existing pension systems of the developed countries. One challenge is obviously the aging of the population. In a world where people die between 80 and 90, it is difficult to maintain parameters that were chosen when the life expectancy was between 60 and 70. Furthermore, increasing the retirement age is not just a way of increasing the resources available to both workers and retirees, which is a good thing in an era of low growth. It is also a response to the need that many people feel for fulfillment through work. For them, to be forced to retire at 60 and to spend more time in retirement in some cases than in a career is not an appetizing prospect. The problem is that individual situations vary widely. Some people have primarily intellectual occupations, and they may wish to remain on the job until they are 70. And it is possible that the number of such people as a share of total employment will increase over time. There are many others, however, who began work early and whose work is arduous or not very rewarding, and who legitimately aspire to retire relatively early, especially since their life expectancy is often lower than that of more highly qualified workers. Unfortunately, recent reforms in many developed countries fail to distinguish adequately between these different types of individual, and in some cases, more is demanded of the latter than of the former, which is why these reforms sometimes provoke strong opposition. One of the main difficulties of pension reform is that the systems one is trying to reform are extremely complex, with different rules for civil servants, private sector workers, and non-workers. For a person who has worked in different types of jobs over the course of a lifetime, which is increasingly common in the younger generations, it is sometimes difficult to know which rules apply. That such complexity exists is not surprising. Today's pension systems were in many cases built in stages, as existing schemes were extended to new social groups and occupations from the 19th century on. But this makes it difficult to obtain everyone's cooperation on reform efforts, because many people feel that they are being treated worse than others. The hodgepodge of existing rules and schemes frequently confuses the issue, and people underestimate the magnitude of the resources already devoted to public pensions, and fail to realize that these amounts cannot be increased indefinitely. For example, the French system is so complex that many younger workers do not have a clear understanding of what they are entitled to. Some even think that they will get nothing, even though they are paying a substantial amount into the system, something like 25% of gross pay. One of the most important reforms the 21st century social state needs to make is to establish a unified retirement scheme based on individual accounts with equal rights for everyone, no matter how complex one's career path. Such a system would allow each person to anticipate exactly what to expect from the PAYGO public plan, thus allowing for more intelligent decisions about private savings, which will inevitably play a more important supplementary role in a low-growth environment. One often hears that a public pension is the patrimony of those without patrimony. This is true, but it does not mean that it would not be wise to encourage people of more modest means to accumulate nest eggs of their own. The social state in poor and emerging countries. Does the kind of social state that emerged in the developed countries in the 20th century have a universal vocation? Will we see a similar development in the poor and emerging countries? Nothing could be less certain. To begin with, there are important differences among the rich countries. The countries of Western Europe seem to have stabilized government revenues at about 45% to 50% of national income, whereas the United States and Japan seem to be stuck at around the 30% to 35% level. Clearly, different choices are possible at equivalent levels of development. If we look at the poorest countries around the world in 1970 to 1980, we find that governments generally took 10% to 15% of national income, both in sub-Saharan Africa and in South Asia, especially India. Turning to countries at an intermediate level of development in Latin America, North Africa, and China, we find governments taking 15% to 20% of national income, lower than in the rich countries at comparable levels of development. The most striking fact is that the gap between the rich and the not-so-rich countries has continued to widen in recent years. Tax levels in the rich countries rose from 30% to 35% of national income in the 1970s to 35% to 40% in the 1980s, before stabilizing at today's levels, whereas tax levels in the poor and intermediate countries decreased significantly. In sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, the average tax bite was slightly below 15% in the 1970s and early 1980s, but fell to a little over 10% in the 1990s. This evolution is a concern in that, in all the developed countries in the world today, building a fiscal and social state has been an essential part of the process of modernization and economic development. The historical evidence suggests that with only 10% to 15% of national income in tax receipts, it is impossible for a state to fulfill much more than its traditional regalian responsibilities. After paying for a proper police force and judicial system, there is not much left to pay for education and health. Another possible choice is to pay everyone, police, judges, teachers, and nurses, poorly, in which case it is unlikely that any of these public services will work well. This can lead to a vicious circle. Poorly functioning public services undermine confidence in government, which makes it more difficult to raise taxes significantly. The development of a fiscal and social state is intimately related to the process of state building as such. Hence, the history of economic development is also a matter of political and cultural development, and each country must find its own distinctive path and cope with its own internal divisions. In the present case, however, it seems that part of the blame lies with the rich countries and international organizations. The initial situation was not very promising. The process of decolonization was marked by a number of chaotic episodes in the period 1950 to 1970. Wars of independence with the former colonial powers, somewhat arbitrary borders, military tensions linked to the Cold War, abortive experiments with socialism, and sometimes a little of all three. After 1980, moreover, the new ultra-liberal wave emanating from the developed countries forced the poor countries to cut their public sectors and lower the priority of developing a tax system suitable to fostering economic development. Recent research has shown that the decline in government receipts in the poorest countries in 1980 to 1990 was due to a large extent to a decrease in customs duties, which had brought in revenues equivalent to about 5% of national income in the 1970s. Trade liberalization is not necessarily a bad thing, but only if it is not peremptorily imposed from without, and only if the lost revenue can gradually be replaced by a strong tax authority capable of collecting new taxes and other substitute sources of revenue. Today's developed countries reduced their tariffs over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries at a pace they judged to be reasonable and with clear alternatives in mind. They were fortunate enough not to have anyone tell them what they ought to be doing instead. This illustrates a more general phenomenon, the tendency of the rich countries to use the less developed world as a field of experimentation, without really seeking to capitalize on the lessons of their own historical experience. What we see in the poor and emerging countries today is a wide range of different tendencies. Some countries, like China, are fairly advanced in the modernization of their tax system. For instance, China has an income tax that is applicable to a large portion of the population and brings in substantial revenues. It is possibly in the process of developing a social state similar to those found in the developed countries of Europe, America, and Asia, albeit with specific Chinese features, and of course great uncertainty as to its political and democratic underpinnings. Other countries, such as India, have had greater difficulty moving beyond an equilibrium based on a low level of taxation. In any case, the question of what kind of fiscal and social state will emerge in the developing world is of the utmost importance for the future of the planet. Chapter 14. Rethinking the Progressive Income Tax. In the previous chapter, I examined the constitution and evolution of the social state, focusing on the nature of social needs and related social spending, education, health, retirement, etc. I treated the overall level of taxes as a given and described its evolution. In this chapter and the next, I will examine more closely the structure of taxes and other government revenues, without which the social state could never have emerged, and attempt to draw lessons for the future. The major 20th century innovation in taxation was the creation and development of the progressive income tax. This institution, which played a key role in the reduction of inequality in the last century, is today seriously threatened by international tax competition. It may also be in jeopardy because its foundations were never clearly thought through, owing to the fact that it was instituted in an emergency that left little time for reflection. The same is true of the progressive tax on inheritances, which was the second major fiscal innovation of the 20th century, and has also been challenged in recent decades. Before I examine these two taxes more closely, however, I must first situate them in the context of progressive taxation in general and its role in modern redistribution. The question of progressive taxation. Taxation is not a technical matter. It is preeminently a political and philosophical issue, perhaps the most important of all political issues. Without taxes, society has no common destiny, and collective action is impossible. This has always been true. At the heart of every major political upheaval lies a fiscal revolution. The Ancien Régime was swept away when the revolutionary assemblies voted to abolish the fiscal privileges of the nobility and clergy and establish a modern system of universal taxation. The American Revolution was born when subjects of the British colonies decided to take their destiny in hand and set their own taxes. No taxation without representation. Two centuries later, the context is different, but the heart of the issue remains the same. How can sovereign citizens democratically decide how much of their resources they wish to devote to common goals, such as education, health, retirement, inequality, reduction, employment, sustainable development, and so on? Precisely what concrete form taxes take is therefore the crux of political conflict in any society. The goal is to reach agreement on who must pay what in the name of what principles. No mean feat, since people differ in many ways. In particular, they earn different incomes and own different amounts of capital. In every society, there are some individuals who earn a lot from work, but inherited little, and vice versa. Fortunately, the two sources of wealth are never perfectly correlated. Views about the ideal tax system are equally varied. One usually distinguishes among taxes on income, taxes on capital, and taxes on consumption. Taxes of each type can be found in varying proportions in nearly all periods. These categories are not exempt from ambiguity, however, and the dividing lines are not always clear. For example, the income tax applies in principle to capital income as well as earned income, and is therefore a tax on capital as well. Taxes on capital generally include any levy on the flow of income from capital, such as the corporate income tax, as well as any tax on the value of the capital stock, such as a real estate tax, an estate tax, or a wealth tax. In the modern era, consumption taxes include value-added taxes, as well as taxes on imported goods, drink, gasoline, tobacco, and services. Such taxes have always existed, and are often the most hated of all, as well as the heaviest burden on the lower class. One thinks of the salt tax under the Ancien Régime. They are often called indirect taxes because they do not depend directly on the income or capital of the individual taxpayer. They are paid indirectly as part of the selling price of a purchased good. In the abstract, one might imagine a direct tax on consumption, which would depend on each taxpayer's total consumption, but no such tax has ever existed. In the 20th century, a fourth category of tax appeared: contributions to government-sponsored social insurance programs. These are a special type of tax on income, usually only income from labor, wages, and remuneration for non-wage labor. The proceeds go to social insurance funds intended to finance replacement income, whether pensions for retired workers or unemployment benefits for unemployed workers. This mode of collection ensures that the taxpayer will be aware of the purpose for which the tax is to be used. Some countries, such as France, also use social contributions to pay for other social spending, such as health insurance and family allowances, so that total social contributions account for nearly half of all government revenue. Rather than clarify the purpose of tax collection, a system of such complexity can actually obscure matters. By contrast, other states, such as Denmark, finance all social spending with an enormous income tax, the revenues from which are allocated to pensions, unemployment and health insurance, and many other purposes. In fact, these distinctions among different legal categories of taxation are partly arbitrary. Beyond these definitional quibbles, a more pertinent criterion for characterizing different types of tax is the degree to which each type is proportional or progressive. A tax is called proportional when its rate is the same for everyone. The term flat tax is also used. A tax is progressive when its rate is higher for some than for others, whether it be those who earn more, those who own more, or those who consume more. A tax can also be regressive when its rate decreases for richer individuals, either because they are partially exempt, either legally as a result of fiscal optimization or illegally through evasion, or because the law imposes a regressive rate, like the famous poll tax that cost Margaret Thatcher her post as Prime Minister in 1990. In the modern fiscal state, total tax payments are often close to proportional to individual income, especially in countries where the total is large. This is not surprising, It is impossible to tax half of national income to finance an ambitious program of social entitlements without asking everyone to make a substantial contribution. The logic of universal rights that governed the development of the modern fiscal and social state fits rather well, moreover, with the idea of a proportional or slightly progressive tax. It would be wrong, however, to conclude that progressive taxation plays only a limited role in modern redistribution. First, even if taxation overall is fairly close to proportional for the majority of the population, the fact that the highest incomes and largest fortunes are taxed at significantly higher or lower rates can have a strong influence on the structure of inequality. In particular, the evidence suggests that progressive taxation of very high incomes and very large estates partly explains why the concentration of wealth never regained its astronomic Belle Époque levels after the shocks of 1914 to 1945. Conversely, the spectacular decrease in the progressivity of the income tax in the United States and Britain since 1980, even though both countries had been among the leaders in progressive taxation after World War II, probably explains much of the increase in the very highest earned incomes. At the same time, the recent rise of tax competition in a world of free-flowing capital has led many governments to exempt capital income from the progressive income tax. This is particularly true in Europe, whose relatively small states have thus far proved incapable of achieving a coordinated tax policy. The result is an endless race to the bottom, leading, for example, to cuts in corporate tax rates and to the exemption of interest, dividends, and other financial revenues from the taxes to which labor incomes are subject. One consequence of this is that in most countries, taxes have, or will soon, become regressive at the top of the income hierarchy. For example, a detailed study of French taxes in 2010, which looked at all forms of taxation, found that the overall rate of taxation, 47% of national income on average, broke down as follows. The bottom 50% of the income distribution pay a rate of 40 to 45%. The next 40% pay 45 to 50%. But the top 5%, and even more, the top 1%, pay lower rates, with the top 0.1% paying only 35%. The high tax rates on the poor reflect the importance of consumption taxes and social contributions, which together account for three-quarters of French tax revenues. The slight progressivity observed in the middle class is due to the growing importance of the income tax. Conversely, the clear regressivity in the top centiles reflects the importance at this level of capital income, which is largely exempt from progressive taxation. The effect of this outweighs the effect of taxes on the capital stock, which are the most progressive of all. All signs are that taxes elsewhere in Europe, and probably also in the United States, follow a similar bell curve, which is probably even more pronounced than this imperfect estimate indicates. If taxation at the top of the social hierarchy were to become more regressive in the future, the impact on the dynamics of wealth inequality would likely be significant, leading to a very high concentration of capital. Clearly, such a fiscal secession of the wealthiest citizens could potentially do great damage to fiscal consent in general. Consensus support for the fiscal and social state, which is already fragile in a period of low growth, would be further reduced, especially among the middle class, who would naturally find it difficult to accept that they should pay more than the upper class. Individualism and selfishness would flourish. Since the system as a whole would be unjust, why continue to pay for others? If the modern social state is to continue to exist, it is therefore essential that the underlying tax system retain a minimum of progressivity, or at any rate, that it not become overtly regressive at the top. Furthermore, looking at the progressivity of the tax system by examining how heavily top incomes are taxed obviously fails to weigh inherited wealth, whose importance has been increasing. In practice, estates are much less heavily taxed than income. This exacerbates what I have called Rastignac's dilemma. If individuals were classified by centile of total resources accrued over a lifetime, including both earned income and capitalized inheritance, which is a more satisfactory criterion for progressive taxation, the bell curve would be even more markedly regressive at the top of the hierarchy than it is when only labor incomes are considered. One final point bears emphasizing. To the extent that globalization weighs particularly heavily on the least skilled workers in the wealthy countries, a more progressive tax system might in principle be justified, adding yet another layer of complexity to the overall picture. To be sure, if one wants to maintain total taxes at about 50% of national income, it is inevitable that everyone must pay a substantial amount. But instead of a slightly progressive tax system, leaving aside the very top of the hierarchy, one can easily imagine a more steeply progressive one. This would not solve all the problems, but it would be enough to improve the situation of the least skilled significantly. If the tax system is not made more progressive, it should come as no surprise that those who derive the least benefit from free trade may well turn against it. The progressive tax is indispensable for making sure that everyone benefits from globalization, and the increasingly glaring absence of progressive taxation may ultimately undermine support for a globalized economy. For all of these reasons, a progressive tax is a crucial component of the social state. It played a central role in its development and in the transformation of the structure of inequality in the 20th century, and it remains important for ensuring the viability of the social state in the future. But progressive taxation is today under serious threat, both intellectually, because its various functions have never been fully debated, and politically, because tax competition is allowing entire categories of income to gain exemption from the common rules. The progressive tax in the 20th century, an ephemeral product of chaos. To gaze backward for a moment, how did we get to this point? First, it is important to realize that progressive taxation was as much a product of two world wars as it was of democracy. It was adopted in a chaotic climate that called for improvisation, which is part of the reason why its various purposes were not sufficiently thought through and why it is being challenged today. To be sure, a number of countries adopted a progressive income tax before the outbreak of World War I. In France, the law creating a general tax on income was passed on July 15, 1914, in direct response to the anticipated financial needs of the impending conflict, after being buried in the Senate for several years. The law would not have passed had a declaration of war not been imminent. Aside from this exception, most countries adopted a progressive income tax after due deliberation in the normal course of parliamentary proceedings. Such a tax was adopted in Britain, for example, in 1909, and in the United States in 1913. Several countries in Northern Europe, a number of German states, and Japan adopted a progressive income tax even earlier. Denmark in 1870, Japan in 1887, Prussia in 1891, and Sweden in 1903. Even though not all the developed countries had adopted a progressive tax by 1910, an international consensus was emerging around the principle of progressivity and its application to overall income. That is, to the sum of income from labor, including both wage and non-wage labor, and capital income of all kinds, including rent, interest, dividends, profits, and in some cases, capital gains. To many people, such a system appeared to be both a more just and a more efficient way of apportioning taxes. Overall income measured each person's ability to contribute, and progressive taxation offered a way of limiting the inequalities produced by industrial capitalism while maintaining respect for private property and the forces of competition. Many books and reports published at the time helped popularize the idea and win over some political leaders and liberal economists, although many would remain hostile to the very principle of progressivity, especially in France. Is the progressive income tax therefore the natural offspring of democracy and universal suffrage? Things are actually more complicated. Indeed, tax rates, even on the most astronomical incomes, remained extremely low prior to World War I. This was true everywhere, without exception. The magnitude of the political shock due to the war is quite clear in PDF Figure 14.1, which shows the evolution of the top rate, that is, the tax rate on the highest income bracket in the United States, Britain, Germany, and France, from 1900 to 2013. The top rate stagnated at insignificant levels until 1914, and then skyrocketed after the war. These curves are typical of those seen in other wealthy countries. In France, the 1914 income tax law provided for a top rate of just 2%, which applied to only a tiny minority of taxpayers. It was only after the war, in a radically different political and financial context, that the top rate was raised to modern levels, 50% in 1920, then 60% in 1924, and even 72% in 1925. Particularly striking is the fact that the crucial law of June 25, 1920, which raised the top rate to 50% and can actually be seen as a second coming of the income tax, was adopted by the so-called Blue Sky Chamber, one of the most right-wing chambers of deputies in the history of the French Republic, with its National Bloc majority made up largely of the very delegations who had most vehemently opposed the creation of an income tax with a top rate of 2% before the war. This complete reversal of the right-wing position on progressive taxation was, of course, due to the disastrous financial situation created by the war. During the conflict, the government had run up considerable debts, and despite the ritual speeches in which politician after politician declared that Germany will pay, everyone knew that new fiscal resources would have to be found. Post-war shortages and the recourse to the printing press had driven inflation to previously unknown heights, so that the purchasing power of workers remained below 1914 levels, and several waves of strikes in May and June of 1919 threatened the country with paralysis. In such circumstances, political proclivities hardly mattered. New sources of revenue were essential, and no one believed that those with the highest incomes ought to be spared. The Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was fresh in everyone's mind. It was in this chaotic and explosive situation that the modern progressive income tax was born. The German case is particularly interesting, because Germany had had a progressive income tax for more than 20 years before the war. Throughout that period of peace, tax rates were never raised significantly. In Prussia, the top rate remained stable at 3% from 1891 to 1914, and then rose to 4% from 1915 to 1918, before ultimately shooting up to 40% in 1919 to 1920 in a radically changed political climate. In the United States, which was intellectually and politically more prepared than any other country to accept a steeply progressive income tax and would lead the movement in the interwar period, it was again not until 1918 to 1919 that the top rate was abruptly increased, first to 67 and then to 77%. In Britain, the top rate was set at 8% in 1909, a fairly high level for the time. But again, it was not until after the war that it was suddenly raised to more than 40%. Of course, it is impossible to say what would have happened had it not been for the shock of 1914 to 1918. A movement had clearly been launched. Nevertheless, it seems certain that had that shock not occurred, the move toward a more progressive tax system would at the very least have been much slower, and top rates might never have risen as high as they did. The rates in force before 1914, which were always below 10% and generally below 5%, including the top rates, were not very different from tax rates in the 18th and 19th centuries. Even though the progressive tax on total income was a creation of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there were much earlier forms of income tax, generally with different rules for different types of income, and usually with flat or nearly flat rates. For example, a flat rate after allowing for a certain fixed deduction. In most cases, the rates were 5 to 10%, at most. For example, this was true of the categorical or scheduler tax, which applied separate rates to each category, or schedule, of income, land rents, interest, profits, wages, etc. Britain adopted such a categorical tax in 1842, and it remained the British version of the income tax until the creation in 1909 of a super tax, a progressive tax on total income. In Ancien Régime France, there were also various forms of direct taxation of incomes, such as the taille, the dixième, and the vingtième, with typical rates of 5 or 10%, as the names indicate, apply to some, but not all sources of income, with numerous exemptions. In 1707, Vauban proposed a dixième royal, which was intended to be a 10% tax on all incomes, including rents paid to aristocratic and ecclesiastical landlords, but it was never fully implemented. Various improvements to the tax system were nevertheless attempted over the course of the 18th century. Revolutionary lawmakers, hostile to the inquisitorial methods of the fallen monarchy, and probably keen as well to protect the emerging industrial bourgeoisie from bearing too heavy a tax burden, chose to institute an indicial tax system. Taxes were calculated on the basis of indices that were supposed to reflect the taxpayer's ability to pay rather than actual income, which did not have to be declared. For instance, the door and window tax was based on the number of doors and windows in the taxpayer's primary residence, which was taken to be an index of wealth. Taxpayers liked this system because the authorities could determine how much tax they owed without having to enter their homes, much less examine their account books. The most important tax under the new system, created in 1792, the property tax, was based on the rental value of all real estate owned by the taxpayer. The income tax was based on estimates of average rental value, which were revised once a decade when the tax authorities inventoried all property in France. Taxpayers were not required to declare their actual income. Since inflation was slow, this made little difference. In practice, this real estate tax amounted to a flat tax on rents and was not very different from the British categorical tax. The effective rate varied from time to time and département to département, but never exceeded 10%. To round out the system, the nascent Third Republic decided in 1872 to impose a tax on income from financial assets. This was a flat tax on interest, dividends, and other financial revenues, which were rapidly proliferating in France at the time, but almost totally exempt from taxation, even though similar revenues were taxed in Britain. Once again, however, the tax rate was set quite low, 3% from 1872 to 1890, and then 4% from 1890 to 1914, at any rate in comparison with the rates assessed after 1920. Until World War I, it seems to have been the case in all the developed countries that a tax on income was not considered reasonable unless the rate was under 10%, no matter how high the taxable income. The progressive tax in the Third Republic. Interestingly, this was also true of the progressive inheritance or estate tax, which, along with the progressive income tax, was the second important fiscal innovation of the early 20th century. Estate tax rates also remained quite low until 1914. See PDF figure 14.2. Once again, the case of France under the Third Republic is emblematic. Here was a country that was supposed to nurse a veritable passion for the ideal of equality, in which universal male suffrage was re-established in 1871, and which nevertheless stubbornly refused for nearly half a century to fully embrace the principle of progressive taxation. Attitudes did not really change until World War I made change inevitable. To be sure, the estate tax instituted by the French Revolution, which remained strictly proportional from 1791 to 1901, was made progressive by the law of February 25, 1901. In reality, however, not much changed. The highest rate was set at 5% from 1902 to 1910, and then at 6.5% from 1911 to 1914, and applied to only a few dozen fortunes every year. In the eyes of wealthy taxpayers, such rates seemed exorbitant. Many felt that it was a sacred duty to ensure that a son would succeed his father, thereby perpetuating the family property, and that such straightforward perpetuation should not incur a tax of any kind. In reality, however, the low inheritance tax did not prevent estates from being passed on largely intact from one generation to the next. The effective average rate on the top centile of inheritances was no more than 3% after the reform of 1901, compared to 1% under the proportional regime in force in the 19th century. In hindsight, it is clear that the reform had scarcely any impact on the process of accumulation and hyperconcentration of wealth that was underway at the time, regardless of what contemporaries may have believed. It is striking, moreover, how frequently opponents of progressive taxation, who were clearly in the majority among the economic and financial elite of Belle Époque France, rather hypocritically relied on the argument that France, being a naturally egalitarian country, had no need of progressive taxes. A typical and particularly instructive example is that of Paul Leroy Beaulieu, one of the most influential economists of the day, who in 1881 published his famous Essai sur la répartition des richesses et sur la tendance à une moindre inégalité des conditions. Essay on the Distribution of Wealth and the Tendency Toward Reduced Inequality of Conditions, a work that went through numerous editions up to the eve of World War I. Leroy Beaulieu actually had no data of any kind to justify his belief in a tendency toward a reduced inequality of conditions. But never mind that. He managed to come up with dubious and not very convincing arguments based on totally irrelevant statistics to show that income inequality was decreasing. At times, he seemed to notice that his argument was flawed, and he then simply stated that reduced inequality was just around the corner, and that in any case, nothing of any kind must be done to interfere with the miraculous process of commercial and financial globalization, which allowed French savers to invest in the Panama and Suez canals, and would soon extend to Tsarist Russia. Clearly, Leroy Beaulieu was fascinated by the globalization of his day and scared stiff by the thought that a sudden revolution might put it all in jeopardy. There is, of course, nothing inherently reprehensible about such a fascination, as long as it does not stand in the way of sober analysis. The great issue in France in 1900 to 1910 was not the imminence of a Bolshevik revolution, which was no more likely than a revolution is today, but the advent of progressive taxation. For Leroy Beaulieu and his colleagues of the center-right, in contrast to the monarchist right, there was one unanswerable argument to progressivity, which right-thinking people should oppose tooth and nail. France, he maintained, became an egalitarian country thanks to the French Revolution, which redistributed the land, up to a point, and above all established equality before the law with the civil code, which instituted equal property rights and the right of free contract. Hence, there was no need for a progressive and confiscatory tax. Of course, he added, such a tax might well be useful in a class-ridden aristocratic society like that of Britain across the English Channel, but not in France. As it happens, if Leroy Beaulieu had bothered to consult the probate records published by the tax authorities shortly after the reform of 1901, he would have discovered that wealth was nearly as concentrated in Republican France during the Belle Époque as it was in monarchical Britain. In parliamentary debate in 1907 and 1908, proponents of the income tax frequently referred to these statistics. This interesting example shows that even a tax with low rates can be a source of knowledge and a force for democratic transparency. In other countries, the estate tax was also transformed after World War I. In Germany, the idea of imposing a small tax on the very largest estates was extensively discussed in parliamentary debate at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th. Leaders of the Social Democratic Party, starting with August Bebel and Eduard Bernstein, pointed out that an estate tax would make it possible to decrease the heavy burden of indirect taxes on workers, who would then be able to improve their lot. But the Reichstag could not agree on a new tax. The reforms of 1906 and 1909 did institute a very small estate tax, but bequests to a spouse or children, that is, the vast majority of estates, were entirely exempt, no matter how large. It was not until 1919 that the German estate tax was extended to family bequests, and the top rate, on the largest estates, was abruptly increased from 0% to 35%. The role of the war and of the political changes it induced seems to have been absolutely crucial. It is hard to see how the stalemate of 1906 to 1909 would have been overcome otherwise. PDF figure 14.2 shows a slight upward tick in Britain around the turn of the century, somewhat greater for the estate tax than for the income tax. The rate on the largest estates, which had been 8% since the reform of 1896, rose to 15% in 1908, a fairly substantial amount. In the United States, a federal tax on estates and gifts was not instituted until 1916, but its rate very quickly rose to levels higher than those found in France and Germany. Confiscatory taxation of excessive incomes, an American invention. When we look at the history of progressive taxation in the 20th century, it is striking to see how far out in front Britain and the United States were, especially the latter, which invented the confiscatory tax on excessive incomes and fortunes. PDF figures 14.1 and 14.2 are particularly clear in this regard. This finding stands in such stark contrast to the way most people, both inside and outside the United States and Britain, have seen those two countries since 1980, that it is worth pausing a moment to consider the point further. Between the two world wars, all the developed countries began to experiment with very high top rates, frequently in a rather erratic fashion. But it was the United States that was the first country to try rates above 70%, first on income in 1919 to 1922, and then on estates in 1937 to 1939. When a government taxes a certain level of income or inheritance at a rate of 70 or 80%, the primary goal is obviously not to raise additional revenue, because these very high brackets never yield much. It is rather to put an end to such incomes and large estates, which lawmakers have for one reason or another come to regard as socially unacceptable and economically unproductive. Or, if not to end them, then at least to make it extremely costly to sustain them and strongly discourage their perpetuation. Yet, there is no absolute prohibition or expropriation. The progressive tax is thus a relatively liberal method for reducing inequality, in the sense that free competition and private property are respected, while private incentives are modified in potentially radical ways, but always according to rules thrashed out in democratic debate. The progressive tax thus represents an ideal compromise between social justice and individual freedom. It is no accident that the United States and Britain, which throughout their histories have shown themselves to value individual liberty highly, adopted more progressive tax systems than many other countries. Note, however, that the countries of continental Europe, especially France and Germany, explored other avenues after World War II, such as taking public ownership of firms and directly setting executive salaries. These measures, which also emerged from democratic deliberation, in some ways served as substitutes for progressive taxes. Other, more specific factors also mattered. During the Gilded Age, many observers in the United States worried that the country was becoming increasingly inegalitarian and moving farther and farther away from its original pioneering ideal. In Wilfred King's 1915 book on the distribution of wealth in the United States, he worried that the nation was becoming more like what he saw as the hyper-inegalitarian societies of Europe. In 1919, Irving Fisher, then president of the American Economic Association, went even further. He chose to devote his presidential address to the question of U.S. inequality, and in no uncertain terms, told his colleagues that the increasing concentration of wealth was the nation's foremost economic problem. Fisher found King's estimates alarming. The fact that 2% of the population owns more than 50% of the wealth, and that 2/3 of the population owns almost nothing, struck him as an undemocratic distribution of wealth, which threatened the very foundations of U.S. society. Rather than restrict the share of profits or the return on capital arbitrarily, possibilities Fisher mentioned, only to reject them, he argued that the best solution was to impose a heavy tax on the largest estates. He mentioned a tax rate of 2/3 the size of the estate, rising to 100% if the estate was more than 3 generations old. It is striking to see how much more Fisher worried about inequality than Leroy Beaulieu did, even though Leroy Beaulieu lived in a far more inegalitarian society. The fear of coming to resemble old Europe was no doubt part of the reason for the American interest in progressive taxes. Furthermore, the Great Depression of the 1930s struck the United States with extreme force, and many people blamed the economic and financial elites for having enriched themselves while leading the country to ruin. Bear in mind that the share of top incomes in U.S. national income peaked in the late 1920s, largely due to enormous capital gains on stocks. Roosevelt came to power in 1933, when the crisis was already 3 years old, and 1/4 of the country was unemployed. He immediately decided on a sharp increase in the top income tax rate, which had been decreased to 25% in the late 1920s, and again under Hoover's disastrous presidency. The top rate rose to 63% in 1933, and then to 79% in 1937, surpassing the previous record of 1919. In 1942, the Victory Tax Act raised the top rate to 88%, and in 1944, it went up again to 94% due to various surtaxes. The top rate then stabilized at around 90% until the mid-1960s, but then it fell to 70% in the early 1980s. All told, over the period 1932 to 1980, nearly half a century, the top federal income tax rate in the United States averaged 81%. It is important to emphasize that no continental European country has ever imposed such high rates, except in exceptional circumstances, for a few years at most, and never for as long as half a century. In particular, France and Germany had top rates between 50 and 70% from the late 1940s until the 1980s, but never as high as 80 to 90%. The only exception was Germany in 1947 to 1949, when the rate was 90%. But this was a time when the tax schedule was fixed by the occupying powers, in practice, the U.S. authorities. As soon as Germany regained fiscal sovereignty in 1950, the country quickly returned to rates more in keeping with its traditions, and the top rate fell within a few years to just over 50%. See PDF figure 14.1. We see exactly the same phenomenon in Japan. The Anglo-Saxon attraction to progressive taxation becomes even clearer when we look at the estate tax. In the United States, the top estate tax rate remained between 70 and 80% from the 1930s to the 1980s, while in France and Germany, the top rate never exceeded 30 to 40%, except for the years 1946 to 1949 in Germany. See PDF figure 14.2. The only country to match or surpass peak U.S. estate tax rates was Britain. The rates applicable to the highest British incomes, as well as estates in the 1940s, was 98%, a peak attained again in the 1970s, an absolute historical record. Note, too, that both countries distinguished between earned income, that is, income from labor, including both wages and non-wage compensation, and unearned income, meaning capital income, rent, interests, dividends, etc. The top rates indicated in PDF Figure 14.1 for the United States and Britain apply to unearned income. At times, the top rate on earned income was slightly lower, especially in the 1970s. This distinction is interesting because it is a translation into fiscal terms of the suspicion that surrounded very high incomes. All excessively high incomes were suspect, but unearned incomes were more suspect than earned incomes. The contrast between attitudes then and now, with capital income treated more favorably today than labor income in many countries, especially in Europe, is striking. Note, too, that although the threshold for application of the top rates has varied over time, it has always been extremely high. Expressed in terms of average income in the decade 2000 to 2010, the threshold has generally ranged between 500,000 and 1 million euros. In terms of today's income distribution, the top rate would therefore apply to less than 1% of the population, generally somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5%. The urge to tax unearned income more heavily than earned income reflects an attitude that is also consistent with a steeply progressive inheritance tax. The British case is particularly interesting in a long-run perspective. Britain was the country with the highest concentration of wealth in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The shocks, destruction, expropriation, endured by large fortunes fell less heavily there than on the continent. Yet Britain chose to impose its own fiscal shock, less violent than war, but nonetheless significant. The top rate ranged from 70 to 80% or more throughout the period 1940 to 1980. No other country devoted more thought to the taxation of inheritances in the 20th century, especially between the two world wars. In November 1938, Josiah Wedgwood, in the preface to a new edition of his classic 1929 book on inheritance, agreed with his compatriot Bertrand Russell that the plutodemocracies and their hereditary elites had failed to stem the rise of fascism. He was convinced that political democracies that do not democratize their economic systems are inherently unstable. In his eyes, a steeply progressive inheritance tax was the main tool for achieving the economic democratization that he believed to be necessary. The explosion of executive salaries, the role of taxation. After experiencing a great passion for equality from the 1930s through the 1970s, the United States and Britain veered off with equal enthusiasm in the opposite direction. Over the past three decades, their top marginal income tax rates, which had been significantly higher than the top rates in France and Germany, fell well below French and German levels. While the latter remained stable at 50 to 60,